It's Joe and Eddie. There's a meeting here tonight. In fact, there's a meeting here this morning. I'm Jim Park. David Allen Punt is with us and joining us now from Maryland, right on the edge of Washington, D.C., Doug Greenwald of Preserving Bible Times. Doug, good morning to you.
Good morning, Jim and David.
Yeah, and
good morning.
You're on the edge of Washington. I keep thinking you're in a very busy, crowded place. Does Maryland have open space? Is it just, I've never just been through it once. I've never seen much of it. What's Maryland?
Actually, Western Maryland might as well be rural America if you've ever driven out there. Oh. And we're in Columbia, which is between Baltimore and Washington, D.C. And Columbia was the first, grand plan community in the United States. Well, probably the second one. I think Levittown, New York was. But the Rouse brothers did this one here. And half of Columbia is parks and trails and streams. And so they've done a really good job of keeping their open spaces in this part of Maryland. Not so true down in Montgomery County.
What's the population of Columbia then?
Oh, I have no idea. But if I could guess, I would say 200,000.
Oh, how close is your nearest neighbor?
6 inches.
Daniel Boone would move west, I think. He would move west and say there's not enough elbow room.
When you live in a villa, you're just 6 inches apart.
Yeah. How thick is the wall?
Actually, we've never heard our neighbors, so they really did a good job on the sound deadening.
Yeah, okay. Well, you're certainly at the hub of a lot of activity there right next to Washington, D.C., and at Preserving Bible Times, I know there have been a lot of new contacts lately. You've got this 3D map, which shows the topography of Israel. And for those listeners who'd like to see it, it's on our website, BrokenRoadRadio.com. You can go up to Holy Land Views, and you'll see a little tab underneath there on the submenu, the 3D map of Israel. Take a look at that. And a lot of folks sales been good?
Actually, every day the phone is ringing, and we're shipping them to China, the Philippines, Europe, Canada, of course, obviously, as well as the United States, because those people who have long wanted a very economical, portable, easy to take around with you, topographical, three-dimensional map of Israel have never been able to find one. And when the word is out there, they just want it, period, the end. So it's been an exciting time to talk to people because obviously they're into biblical geography, which means they're into biblical context, and it leads to lots of other fascinating discussions. But we're just happy that we can help meet a need for some people who've long wanted such a tool.
Well, preservingbibletimes.org. Now, it's not on your website yet, right? The map itself.
Facebook page, okay. We just loaded it up there. It was easier to do that there. Ah. And you can get great pictures of this new 3D Israel map just by going to Facebook and then keying in the keywords, Preserving Bible Times, and it'll take you right to our Facebook page, and you can see all these pictures.
Uh-huh. Outstanding. But in order to purchase it, you still need to make a phone call. Okay. We're talking about the topography of Israel and how it affects our understanding of Scripture. And you've had us going up and down. We were at 30,000 feet and then 20,000 feet. We finally made it to ground level, and you took us back up in a helicopter last week. And we took a look at Israel from north to south. Where are we headed this week, and what's our altitude at the moment?
Well, I think we'll stay on ground level for a while here and maybe start our thoughts in this groundbreaking discussion here of using internet radio to discuss a highly visualized subject like geography, and talk about the highs and lows of Israel. For starters, I think it helps to appreciate that Israel is about the size of Vermont, a very small country. 150 miles north-south, maximum maybe 68 miles east-west at the bottom and much narrower at the northern part of the country. And when you look at a topographical map, the highs and the lows just sort of leap out at you. Let's start with the low. In Israel, it's known as the Jordan Valley Rift, but in a larger scale, it's known as the Syro-African Rift. It's the lowest geological depression on the face of the earth that you can still walk on. It extends up into Turkey in the north and down to Lake Victoria and Uganda in the south. And in Israel, it creates the Jordan Valley. And in that valley is the Dead Sea at 1,300 feet below sea level. It's the lowest place on the face of the earth. Maybe 90 miles north, we have the Sea of Galilee, which really is a lake to people who've been born and raised in the Midwest. And it's 700 feet below sea level. And this is the lowest part in Israel, this valley. And as you might expect, on either side of this low, you find the two highs. To the east, you find the Jordanian escarpment, which was Moab and Edom in biblical times, 2,000 feet elevation above the bottom of the valley floor. On the western side, you have what's known as the Central Ridge and the Judean Wilderness Escarpment, starting with a 1,000-foot drop there. And so you've got two highs on either side of a north-south low running up and down the country. Now, the high on the left we call the Central Ridge Route. It'll go down probably as far south as Hebron, which is 3,000 foot in the air. It'll go north along this Central Ridge to Jerusalem at about 2,650 feet in the air. It continues to go north into the hill country of Samaria, where it gets back up to around 3,000 feet. And it's very evident here when you look at a topographical map, you've got this hump running through the center of Israel, known as the Central Ridge Route. And so those are the two prominent highs and lows in this land. And why is that significant? Because that's where people travel. A lot of people will travel in the low part, the Jordan Valley Rift, both traders as well as armies, as well as people going from one part to another. And on the Jordanian side, on the high part of this escarpment, is in antiquity was known as the King's Highway. That's another north-south trade route, travel route, economic route. And the third one, of course, is the Central Ridge Route, which runs right through the center of the country.
Now, the King's Highway, was that east of the Dead Sea, northeast of the Jordan?
That is correct. Okay. It's in what we would know as the Jordanian Escarpment today.
By the way, it's a real help if you want to look at that map as we're speaking, the one on BrokenRoadRadio.com under Holy Land Views. You got to click on the link once you get there, and then you'll have a picture of that 3D map that we talked about. There were trade routes along the coast also, weren't there? How did Egypt come north? What route did they take?
The second lowest part in Israel, it's the seacoast, the Mediterranean seacoast, which is obviously at zero elevation. And between the Central Ridge and between the coast is a buffer zone area, sort of an intermediate area known as the Shvelah, the gentle Judean hills. And that was sort of the buffer zone that separated the Philistines from the Israelites in the early days of biblical history. Now, you think, now why are we talking about this? What does this have to do with the biblical story? Well, as you might expect, perhaps quite a bit. When Joshua conquered Jericho and brought this embryonic nation into the land, he had another battle at Ai, and then a couple more skirmishes, and then he took this embryonic nation of Israel into the hill country of Samaria, and that was the first home for the nation. And if you've ever been to the hill country of Samaria, it is hilly, deep ridges, deep valleys, elevation differences from up to 3,000 feet down into gorges, maybe 1,000 foot below. And this geography, this topography, provided great protection for this brand new nation who just entered this promised land, because the Egyptians and later the Philistines control the coastal plain, and they run up and down this plain with their chariots. But no way can these chariots get into this rugged hill country. And so one of the first appreciations of this land is how God provided this hill country in the central spine of Israel as protection for this brand new country, this chosen people in this promised land for quite some time.
Of course, they were surrounded by enemies as they came in. Now, they came in from the east because as they wandered the desert, they would have come up, and correct me, I'm really asking a question here, south of the Dead Sea through that desert pass over Edom and Moab and then northward, and then basically attacked that land coming from the east. And of course, we know about the half-tribes on the east side of the Jordan that were left behind because they were sheep herders, weren't they? I mean, the land itself was conducive to that, and that was their background.
we're going to pick up the sheep herding thing a little bit here when we talk about rainfall and the implications for agricultural pursuits. But you're quite right. They came up what we know today as the Jordanian Escarpment through Moab and Edom. And then they went down into the Jordan Valley Rift, where Jericho is, crossed the Jordan, defeated Jericho, and then went up into the Judean hill country, and then went north into what we know as the Samaritan hill country today, and that's where they were protected. Now,
where's the mountain that Moses died upon?
That would be in the Jordanian escarpment.
Yeah, I'm just looking at the map here. I wish I could zoom in on the website, but... But I think I see the location there, because there's some pretty high hills. Now, how high are those mountains on the east side of the Jordan?
There's a 2,000-foot differential between the bottom of the Jordan Valley and the top of that ridge.
Okay.
A 1,000-foot differential over on the western side in Israel. Now, let's just pause here. Okay, so we got mountainous areas and we've got coastal plain flat areas. Big deal. Well, it really is a big deal. Because a lot of the history, the early history of the Old Testament, is explained by where you live, where you reside. Let me make this observation in terms of our own country. Do you think there's a difference between the sociology, the rate of technology pursuit, and the relative sophistication of rural West Virginia, hill country, and Silicon Valley in California?
Well, indeed, there's a huge cultural difference.
Absolutely. And so we get the same thing going on in the Old Testament. Being a hill country people, being sort of semi-mountainous people, the culture of Israel develops at a slower rate. The sophistication for technology develops at a much slower rate than it does over on the coast. And so one of the backdrops of the Old Testament period is the Philistines are technologically superior to the Israelites who are up in these mountains. And part of that superiority is that they have found, because they're seafaring people, and they've interacted with the Hittites to the north, and they've figured out how you make what we would call steel weaponry, how to carbonize iron ore to convert it into steel. So they're technologically sophisticated when it comes to metallurgy because they're coastal people, they're advanced people. Meanwhile, the Israelites up here in the mountains, they don't have any steel weaponry at all. At best, they have bronze, which is to put a little bit of tin, maybe 8% tin, into copper. And that's what you fashion your weaponry out of. And if you've ever seen a bronze sword and contrasted it with a steel sword, there is absolutely no comparison. And it's interesting, I was reading not too long ago one commentator who said, much of the history of the Old Testament is shaped by metallurgy. You know, we just don't think of it that way. But the domination that the Philistines had over the Israelites was one of superior weaponry. And as a hill country people, they never were going to develop that superiority because they don't see trade and they're not seafaring people and they cannot interact with others in the eastern Mediterranean to develop technology, et cetera, et cetera. So with that as a backdrop, it's fascinating what God decides to do with David. This probably 21-year-old young man is anointed by Samuel to be king. And just put yourself in David's shoes for a moment. If you were anointed king to be by Samuel in Bethlehem, what would you sort of envision the next couple of years were going to be like as the king in waiting?
Well, you've got Saul there already. And I guess a lot depends upon the level of confidence you have in Saul, which was waning by then. I mean, that's why Samuel made the move. God was making a change here. I'd tremble, I think. I'd be in fear and trepidation of what to expect, and knowing that these Philistines to my west were better armed than I am. I would see conflict.
It's a New Testament verse, but I wondered if David had a thought that, so if God is for me, who can be against me? I don't know what David thought, but I would have guessed he probably would have had a fairly short timeline saying, you know, in a year or two, I'm probably going to be king. I mean, why would I be anointed right now if that were not the case? Well, the next 10 years didn't turn out at all like he might have hoped and wished it would. He was on the run from Saul for 9 of those years. And finally, at the beginning of the 9th year, he hires himself out to be a mercenary for the king of Gath, which is one of the five Philistine city-states in that loose confederation called the Philistines. And I would suggest to you that it's there, as he develops the confidence of the king of Gath, that he sees how they're making their steel weaponry, how to take carbon and put it into molten iron ore to make steel. And so when he becomes king, probably 18 months later, if you read the Old Testament record, it doesn't take too long, and the Philistines are no longer a military issue for the nation of Israel. In fact, the golden age of David and Solomon in the most territorial expansion ever of Israel in its history takes place. And in God's providence, he has a very surprising decade in front of this anointed king-to-be David, because he wants his nation to have superiority, at a minimum, or at least equivalence in weaponry with the Philistines. And having David on the run for 10 years from Saul was one way to accomplish that objective. Now, that's not the only thing God was doing, because when you're in charge of 600 mercenaries for 10 years, you learn how to be a pretty good leader, because at its core, a mercenary is an anarchist. And David was about to become king of a nation of stiff-necked peoples, and it was all part of God's training to get him ready, not only to be a leader, but to make sure this nation had weaponry parity with the Philistines. And all of this is rooted in the backstory of coastal people and mountain people and metallurgy. That's why I love physical geography, because it has to do with raw materials, and it has to do with social development and technical sophistication, and all of that is a backdrop to the Old Testament story.
You know, David, this sounds like Guns, Germs, and Steel, Jared Diamond's book on ancient cultures and who survived and who didn't and why. And so now we can see David as an innovator and the gateway for this technological change that that swept the area. Where do they find iron ore? I mean, are there mines, iron mines, iron ore mines? Where do they find these materials?
Way in the south, down around Eilat, if that is on the map, you can find iron ore. And you could also get it in the eastern Mediterranean basin once you knew how to take control of shipping.
Because I have read that one of the things that led to a lot of the warfare that we read about, even in Bible times, was the search for mineral deposits used in making weaponry. And the Israelis were at a distinct disadvantage for a long time until this came along. And I didn't realize, I never made that connection, that it was David acting as a mercenary and exposing himself to the technology of the Philistines that may have initiated that change through Israel. I mean, that's so interesting.
Yeah, you can't get that reading the verses per se, but no. When you begin to take a geographical approach to the narratives that we find in the Old Testament, you suddenly have the ability to start to connect a few dots, and a much bigger story starts to come into view. Well, let's shift gears here a little bit and talk about rainfall. If we were to draw a line through the center of Israel, almost right through Jerusalem, an east-west line, and once we got to Jerusalem, maybe took that line and angled it up towards the northeast, everything south of that line would comprise 75% of the landmass of Israel. But that 75% of the landmass only gets 25% of the annual rainfall. Therefore, the reverse is also true. On the northern side of that line, which comprises only 25% of the landmass of Israel, is where 75% of the rain falls. Now, what kind of impact do you think that has on the country, the topography, the flora, the fauna, and the people who live in each of those distinctly different areas of the country?
Well, it says agriculture, for one thing.
Absolutely. So that's why you're going to have shepherds in the south. And it's just an interesting artifact that any group of people who ends in I-T-E-S, like Israelites, Amalekites, Edomites, if you end in I-T-S, you're pretty much a shepherd agrarian culture. Just one of those facts of history. And because that's about all you can do down here. You're going to get your winter rains of 8 to 10 to 12 inches. You're going to have green grass maybe until about early May. And then you have to start working your way north where more water will fall and there will be more green grass. And that plays into some of the biblical narratives. For example, the patriarchs sort of set up shop in Hebron, which is at the very southern end of the Central Ridge Route here. But when Joseph gets sold into slavery, that takes place up in Dothan, which is at the northern end of the hill country of Samaria. And when you look at a map, you realize that Dothan is probably at least 80 miles north of the home of the patriarchs in Hebron. Hmm. Now, in the world would Joseph's brothers with their flocks be that far north? Answer is, that's where you're going to find green grass in the middle of the summer. And you got nothing but brown grass where you live, and so you're a very migrating people following the rainfall and following the green grass. So understanding those kind of things helps us explain why events happened where they happened. When you looking at a map, it doesn't really make sense why they would have strayed so far from home.
I want to introduce a little more history here and basically ask a question. If we go back to Abraham's time and going on down to Isaac and Jacob, these were nomadic people, were they not? They were going back and forth with a few camels and a few sheep and basically tribal. Then there's the captivity in Israel, in Egypt, where they're now become shepherds and farmers in a rather rich, fertile area of Egypt. And as slaves, they did the work. Is this where they learned the skills they needed to both survive in the desert and to populate the nation of Israel, both sheep herding and farming, or did that just kind of come naturally to them?
Well, I think you have to adapt wherever you find yourself. Certainly, when they went to Egypt, they were shepherds primarily. And, you know, they were there 430 years. So, you know, if we divide 430 by 20, what does that get us?
15, 16 and a half. 16 generations, yep.
True here. So I don't know how much of shepherding skills would have been passed along from generation to generation through 15, 16, 17 generations when you're living in the Nile Delta as farmers all that time. Never really thought about that. Not sure what it means. But when they left Egypt, they certainly still had flocks. And now they were back into a shepherding motif very, very quickly. In fact, they probably had to relearn it in their 40 years in the wilderness. And by the time they got to the promised land, they were back in the shepherding groove again.
Well, is that why the half-tribes stayed east of the Jordan, do you suppose? Because they were sheep herders?
You can be sheep herders over there. Uh-huh. That would help explain that in part. That's not the greatest place to set up shop. But if you're comfortable being a shepherd and you're comfortable with that kind of an environment, it's a tough living, tough life, but you can make it work.
Can you actually climb the mountains on the east side of the Jordan River Valley there and survey the land of Israel? Can you see you're higher there than you are in Israel?
Oh, you are. Like you may recall, I said that the escarpment on the Jordanian side here at the Jordan Valley Rift is 2,000 foot tall from the valley floor. It's only 1,000 foot, the escarpment height on the Israel side, on the western side. So, yeah, there's a 1,000 foot higher elevation on the eastern side Jordan Valley Rift than on the western side. Mm-hmm. If you a pretty good perspective.
Well, I'm thinking the story of Moses and surveying the promised land, though not being able to enter it, was where he met his end. But he did, in fact, have a view of the promised land from that mountaintop, which is kind of interesting. You know, a minor point, but it just clicks. It shows how topography works to clarify what we read in Scripture.
And in my own mind, I just wonder if God was gracious enough to give him that view after a good rain, because you get a lot of particulate matter in the air here, particularly when you have long dry seasons and you've got winds blowing, and it really cuts down on your visibility. But after a good late winter rain, it's amazing how clear the sky is and how far you can see. So I've often wondered, did God in his grace give Moses that glimpse after a good rainy day?
Mm-hmm. Well, the topography certainly is important to our understanding. I think we've established that. And And for those of you who are, you know, there's maps in your Bible, and some of them are show the topography of the land. But I would suggest that you take a peek at this map over at BrokenRoadRadio.com under Holy Land Views. I presume it's plastic that shows the topography of Israel, about 10 inches by 20 inches, framed or unframed. And you could have this right next to you, especially as you go through the Old Testament. What about New Testament readings and understandings? Doug, are those furthered by your understanding of the topography?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when we read that Jesus went from Capernaum to Jerusalem for festivals, you know, we just sort of breeze past that. But when you look at the map, you realize that's a six-day walk. And you realize there are only two ways you can make that journey. And maybe I should wrap up with this observation here. The topography dictates how and where you travel. And how and where you travel dictates the trade routes, as well as the invasion routes. And wherever there's trade, there's people who want to control the trade because you can tax it. So where do you find fortresses on trade routes? Where do you find major battles on trade routes? And so geography dictates trade routes, which dictates placements of fortresses and cities, which dictates where the struggles are going to take place, which dictates where we're going to find people. The reason that Zacchaeus is in Jericho is because they can then tax the north-south trade route that goes up to Jordan Valley Rift, and they can also tax the trade route that goes from Jerusalem up to Jericho. So if you're a tax collector or a chief tax collector, that's a very strategic place to be. So all this stuff is about controlling trade. Those who control trade make money and control power, and that's what a lot skirmishing and the battles going on in the Old Testament record is all about. And it really becomes clear where these things are taking place and why they're taking place when you got a topographical map in front of your eyes and you see the limited number of opportunities you have to create transportation and travel routes in this very diverse, this very rugged land.
And Doug, as you talk and teach, it becomes apparent to me that the ancient culture is really not that much different than we are today. A lot of the same motivations, the same reasons for getting up every day, and a lot of the same reasons for conflict. And just an afterthought here, and David, you might want to reiterate this too. We were talking with John Delancey about the archaeology in Hazor in northern Israel just yesterday, and we were talking about the topography and the avenue into Israel that valley provides north of Galilee for invading armies, for the Assyrians, for the Babylonians, and how it may yet come to be an important place for us in future history. You know, that sounds interesting, doesn't it? Future history. Make it for future battles and potential conflicts.
Well, Hazor sits right along the side, happens to be the western side of the Jordan Valley Rift, and that's one of the main transportation routes, and that's why it's there.
It's amazing how it all goes together. We're speaking with Doug Greenwald, Senior Teaching Fellow and Executive Director at Preserving Bible Times. And you can link to them on our website or just go there directly. PreservingBibleTimes.org is the website. You'll find them just a fountain of information and resources for your church and your small groups and your discussions, and a fascinating place to spend some time. And Doug, we're always grateful for your visits on Wednesdays and look forward to chatting with you again in a week.
Yeah, we probably should end this with yet another exhortation. If anyone has listened to this verbal description of a very physical phenomenon called geography and topography, they ought to go back to the relief map that you've posted up on the Broken Road website, because it will make these words make a lot more sense.
It will, and I was following it as you described it, and it's quite a lesson, a valuable lesson for us too. Doug, again, be blessed. Thank you, and we'll talk to you in a week.
And, hey, thanks, guys.
Music on this Broken Road Radio Wednesday morning by Corey Emerson.